I'm here on a job site with Tim, who owns his own electrical contracting business.
Three employees and two work trucks.
Tim traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance. We're positively here where he needs us most.
They sure are.
With step-by-step help on all his insurance needs, all for shockingly low rates.
Shockingly low, huh?
Just a little bit of electrician humour. Do you get it?
I got it.
You know, it feels like we have a real connection. All right, I'll stop.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Hello and welcome to Empire's very special Gremlins podcast, starring the one and only Zach Galligan, who you may or may not realise was in Gremlins and Gremlins 2 and Waxwork, and now Hatchet 3. And that's one of the many reasons why he came in to say hi and just generally chat about his career and what he thinks about a potential Gremlins 3, amongst other things. The interviewers who were in charge of this particular podcast were Chris Hewitt and Nick DeSemlin. Enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined in the Empire Pod booth by the great Zach Galligan, star of Gremlins, Waxwork, and now, I believe, Hatchet 3.
That is correct, Hatchet 3.
How's that going?
Well, it's going great. It's actually still ongoing.
Okay.
What
are you doing here then?
Luckily, there's been a kind of a month hiatus, at least for some of the cast members.
Okay.
We have a bit that we didn't finish in New Orleans. By design.
Okay.
So we did 3 weeks in New Orleans, and then we just decided there's a sequence without giving it, I can't really give anything away, but there's a sequence where people are in sort of a confined space.
Sure.
So we thought to ourselves, well, should we really do the confined space in muggy, unbearable Louisiana set, or should we just build a set of this small confined space in nice, you know, lost, sunny, dry,
that makes
not humid
sense
LA.
That makes perfect sense. But it's allowed you at least the chance to come to London, where it's pissing down with rain at the moment. So
that's right.
You
yeah.
must be delighted about that.
See, here's the thing. I like the rain. I also lived in LA for 15 years. So when it's raining, I'm always kind of like, a change of pace.
Okay. And you're like you've done so much great horror. You've done Waxwork. You've done
Tales
from the Crypt.
What do you think of it? Because you were watching it.
I thought it was fun. I mean, David Warner,
yeah.
Patrick Meaney, you can't go wrong.
Absolutely.
It's that kind of 80s kind of, it had a bit of the original Fright Night kind of vibe to it.
So 80s. It's a very, very, I find Waxwork, and especially Waxwork 2, I find them deeply strange movies. I mean, even though I'm in them, I find them very, very peculiar movies. And that's probably because Anthony Hickox, who directed them, is a dear friend of mine, you know. I mean, he's an interesting guy. He is an interesting kind of legendary figure in Hollywood, not only in terms of his imagination and his directing, but in terms of his sort of, shall we say, public persona as well.
And so, he's the son of Douglas Hickox.
He is.
Directed Theater of Blood. So it runs in the family.
Theater of Blood, Brannigan too.
Yeah, absolutely.
John Wayne movie.
Absolutely. But with that heritage, he was naturally drawn towards horror. I imagine with the middle name Wolf, you were also naturally drawn towards horror. It was just meant to be, wasn't it?
Well, you know what's funny? It's strange that I've done as many horror films as I have, but maybe it's subconscious because I loved horror movies as a kid.
Yeah.
I loved them. We had a thing in New York on Channel 9 called Chiller Theater. If from that little area, it's kind of a legendary thing, and the opening would be this swamp, and you'd see this disembodied hand kind of comes out of the swamp like this, and it goes Chiller, and it spells out Chiller like this, in these nasty claymation letters are spelled out in front of it, and then the hand reaches down and it scoops up all the letters. It goes like and picks up all the letters like that. And when you're 5 years old,
when you're five,
I don't know about you guys, but when I was five, everything scared me. So the Wizard of Oz, flying monkeys, no, hate them, you know, Wicked Witch, hate them. It was a total scaredy cat.
Oh, yeah.
So I'd see that hand, and before they even started the movie, I was basically completely freaked out. Then they'd show movies like The Blob.
Oh, right. The original, the Steve McQueen one.
Okay. And when you're 5 years old, the part where the old man takes the stick and he pokes it in the blob and he goes up the stick and then he tries to go, oh, don't do that, I'll turn it the other way. And it still goes, you know, he turns it like so that it'll fall down the stick gravity wise and it still goes up his hand.
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, no, don't go up his hand.
And I mean, you've worked with Christopher Lee. Sir Christopher Lee, you know, the great horror icon. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that was when I found out he was cast in Gremlins 2. I was pretty freaked out about that because I loved stuff like The Creeping Unknown and, you know, Dracula's Risen from the Grave, all of the great Hammer stuff. When I was like 8 years old, I would go up to the magazine stand at 86th and Broadway and I would get Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like Eerie and Creepy, all of those Warren magazines. Mm. Did you have any awareness of those magazines? No, we
had things like over here, like Starburst and Fear magazine and things like that. But I only really found out about Famous Monsters of Filmland kind of almost after the fact. It's a shame because I'd love to have got into it.
Mm. I think you can go to various sites online and just like basically download RARs full of the old magazines from the 70s. It's an incredible time capsule. But they ever talked about was Vampire Circus, Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, the early ones, the 1972 ones with like people like Roy Dotrice and
So did you geek out when you were in the same room as Christopher Lee? Did you kind of talk to him about
it? First of all, he's an incredible gentleman. He's one of the nicest human beings you'll ever meet. And he's very, considering the body of work that he's left behind, he's very, very, he's proud, but he's very low key. He didn't carry himself with like, I'm Christopher Lee. You know what I mean? He's not, he's very cool.
Yeah.
And as luck would have it, it was the 200th movie he'd ever done.
Really?
Gremlins 2 was. So we had a huge cake for him with 200, you know, not 200 candles, obviously, but with the 200th, hey, happy 200th movie thing. Like, so we had a big celebration for him. And I think he was very appreciative because, you know, all actors have sort of highs and lows in their careers and hills and valleys. And this was a period kind of in between the Hammer period and before the Star Wars Lord of the Rings sort of re-explosion.
Yeah.
So I think he was extremely gratified by the level of respect that Joe Dante accorded him and was really grateful to be around people who recognized him for his talent.
There are some really sly gags in Gremlins 2, referring to Dracula. There's a moment where the Bat Gremlin goes to the wall and leaves a Batman symbol on the wall. But also when Christopher Lee first sees it, unfurl its cape, and there's a moment and it looks like, have I seen this before?
Yeah,
this
exactly.
There's a moment of deja vu here, which is great because and it kind of sums up Gremlins 2 for me. It's one of my favorite films, and it's probably the most subversive sequel ever made. Warner Brothers didn't seem to be aware of that subversion going into it. I imagine you and Joe were fully in cahoots in that one.
Well, you know, when I got the script from Charlie Haas, I read it and I was like, the tone was very funny. I got it and I was like, really, you're going to attempt to do this? Because, you know, to my knowledge, I don't even think it's been done since then. A sequel that openly winds up the first one.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And rather abrasively, too.
Yeah.
It basically kind of pisses on the first one in certain ways, too. And you're sort of like, really? You really want to go there? And Dante was like, oh, yeah, no, it's going to be great. So we did it. And when it came out, I mean, you got to understand something. I should probably preface this by saying, when we did the first Gremlins, we shot it. I didn't know that much about film or about editing at the time. I was 19. It was the second movie I'd ever done.
Yeah.
I had a feeling in my mind's eye that I was doing a completely other movie, a different movie. I had sort of more of a feeling I was doing like Aliens, like more sort of an action movie. I'm running, I'm this, I'm that, I'm hacking heads off of things. And then Joe says, well, come and see it. It's done, come and see it. So Phoebe and I go and see it. And halfway through it, I'm in this bizarre, strangely lit cartoon. And I'm like, what the heck? Because I was really, really stunned and I was kind of taken aback. Now, of course, in retrospect, it is what it is. I can't even really imagine it in any other way. But at the time, the shock of the new was so... Phoebe and I both, we walked out. We saw it at a tiny screening room, Warner Brothers lot. Joe, Dante, Mike Fennell, Phoebe, and myself. Just the four of us. they're sitting in the back, they're all nervous, wondering about, you know, whether the actors are going to like it, or they don't care, I don't know, or they're pretending to be nervous or whatever it is. And so Phoebe and I, like, neither one of us smoked, so we took some kind of break somewhere so that she and I could talk, and I was like, what do you think? She's like, what do you think? I was like, I have no, we were it was just so different from what we thought that we were creating. So I had a lot more confidence, not confidence, but a sort of awareness about what the second one was going to be like. So they're like, it's going to be great. They told me it was going to be great. I thought, it's, you know, it's going to be great. And it is. It's kind of an amazing movie. I think it's one of the movies that gets better as the years go on. It gets less dated, and the sense of humor sort of gets more in sync.
Yeah, I think it took a while for people to catch up with the film, rather than the other way around.
Yeah, it just got a glowing review in the New York Times, too, when with the Blu-ray coming out.
Oh, fantastic.
They basically just sort of like did a "we are not worthy, we're so sorry about that stupid 1990s review."
Big old mea culpa from the New York Times.
It's incredible. Like, there was we got a slightly different version of it in the UK, didn't we? Because there's a moment where the film stops.
Right.
And Hulk Hogan comes out. That's correct. And who came out in the UK version?
I think John Wayne comes out.
Right. Oh, right. I've seen that one. Yeah.
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 I saw it at the cinema, and it got me the first time around. And then a video, I think they kept the Hulk Hogan one in a video. I need to double check it, but
it's you know, both of those films I watched endlessly as a kid. And I saw something you posted on Twitter quite recently, which piqued my interest. Which I think you said that security guards would stop you when you were leaving the set and search you to make sure you weren't taking anything.
On the second one. Well, I couldn't drive for the first one. And if you watch the VW bug scenes rather closely, you can see I don't think I drive more than 3 or 4 feet in the entire first Gremlins movie, because I didn't have a driver's license. I was a Manhattan boy.
Okay.
If you live in Manhattan, you take the subway and the bus. There's absolutely no point in having a car. It's almost a kind of a detriment. People look at you and go, "Car? Really?"
Yeah.
And they kind of look down their nose at you. So I'd moved out to LA for the second one, so obviously I could drive. Every morning I would drive to the set, get up bright and early, and just crank music on the stereo system on the way there. Usually Volume 4 by Black Sabbath was my that was my go-to tape for that particular film. And so you drive, and they give you an assigned parking space right next to the stage. And then when I left, you have to go out through the lot, and there's a whole, you know, phalanx of security guards. And rather than, after 4 months of doing this, rather than people being like, "Hey Zach, hey, how are you?" Like, every day it was like, "Hey Zach, how are you? Pull over." "Open your trunk. All right, move that to the side." "Lift up the tire. Okay, great. Have a nice day."
That's amazing. You know, and that didn't happen on the first show. That was just the...
Well, I wasn't driving. I was just taken to and from in a van.
What did they think you were going to steal?
I think they thought... Well, it wasn't just... First of all, let me just say, it wasn't just me.
No, it wasn't. It was just like, they had a special lane for you.
That Zach guy. You better watch him.
Blasting Black Sabbath.
When the glove goes on, you got a little bit worried. It's like 3 weeks in, full body cavity search.
Yeah, exactly. No, they basically searched everybody who came to and from the set, because... And most people, I guess, they're not really aware of it, but when we did Gremlins and Gremlins 2, we had anywhere between probably 50 and 70 actual Gremlins that had been constructed. A lot of the other ones were then matted in with special effects later and stuff, if you want crowd scenes, stuff like that, like in the movie theater in the first one. And then you'd probably have about, you know, 20 or 30 versions of Gizmo or Mogwai around. And each one of those creatures was probably worth somewhere in the area of between, like, at the time, $10,000 and $40,000. So it's no different than having, you know, gems or watches lying around, you know? If you're working at a watch store all day long and, you know, you're an employee, you're going to get probably frisked on the way out of the store, you know, or searched, or go through a metal detector or something. So that's what it was. That was the equivalent.
They were worried you weren't seeing these guys as co-stars, but as college funds for your kids. And
they just thought that maybe, you know, somebody would be like, and it wasn't even so much theft, like, for profit. It was like, maybe someone would take one because, for sentimental reasons, someone would take one because they wanted to donate it to Planet Hollywood, whatever. And they were kind of like, this is our shit, we're paying for it, and you can't take it.
Had you been tempted to take one, which one would you have taken?
There was a remote control Gizmo. a little remote giz that was adorable, and you could peel his face off, right? You know, peel his face off, like, and he would have different expressions. So there'd be a kind of a ooh, kind of wide eyed shocked expression face, and then there'd be sort of a grumpy, I'm in the backpack and grumpy and being thrown around the pencils kind of expression that you put on. So I would probably take the remote control one.
And you have a bit of a connection to another big 80s franchise, Ghostbusters, in that you worked with Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray on Nothing Lasts Forever.
Yeah, that was very, very strange kind of set of coincidences, because I did Nothing Lasts Forever. That was the first film I ever did. And the whole story behind that one is like a podcast in and of itself. But we shot that movie summer of 1982, actually finished around June 1982. Then I went off to Columbia University. Being a good New York City boy, staying in town so I could be an actor and everything like that. And I'm on my campus about a year later, and I see this huge, in the middle of the quad, I see this huge kind of like white hearse with a ghost and a little red circle and a red slash through it. And I go, what on earth is that?
Yeah.
Because the movie, you hadn't seen the movie yet. And then I see Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd in these like suits, holding these what seemed to be ray guns.
Yeah.
And I'm going, what the heck is so you have to understand, at the time, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd were gargantuan.
Yeah.
From Saturday Night Live. And basically what Kristen Wiig is now, you know, like in the States. The huge, massive superstars. So there are barricades and about 150, maybe 200 kids behind the barricades. So I just worked with these guys maybe a year earlier.
Yeah.
So I walk up to the barricades and I go, hey, Danny, Billy. And nobody ever calls Bill Murray Billy, except people who've like worked with him and know him, because he says, call me Billy. He doesn't really want to be called. I don't know why he wants to be called Billy. So I waved at them and I shouted, and Murray spots me through the crowd because I'd sort of like pushed my way up to the front, and he goes, it's the kid. and Aykroyd turns around and goes, oh, that's right, so it is. Oh yes, yes, so it is. You know, it's a quick thing like that. So Aykroyd waves to me like, go under the barricade, come over, right?
Yeah.
And so I go under the, like, the policeman goes, you can't go under there. And one of the greatest moments of my life, Murray walks over and goes, it's okay, he's with us, in front of like all of my classmates, and everyone's like freaking out.
That's
so I
amazing.
Go under. So here I am, and I'm chatting with them. They're like, yeah, so you're working with Steven. Oh, great. You know, Spielberg, right?
Because
I hadn't done Gremlins yet, but I'd been cast in it.
Okay.
So yeah, you're gonna do that. Oh, great. Actually, maybe I think I just finished it. Yeah. It was September. I just finished it.
Yeah.
And they're like, so you worked with Steven? Oh, yeah, great. Oh, I'll tell him I said hi. Oh, yeah, sure, I will. This and that. And that. Oh, I'm talking about Spielberg with Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, on the set of Ghostbusters on my college campus. Meanwhile, 18 months earlier, I was doing, like, you know, bad productions of Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah.
In my high school.
It's amazing.
It was just, talk about the shock of the new.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And to think that Ghostbusters and Gremlins were both made at the same time.
And released the same day.
It's crazy, of course. Yeah.
June 8th, 1984, same exact day.
Absolutely. And you wrote a feature about that.
We did a Ghostbusters Gremlins feature where, and I spoke to Dan Aykroyd, and he remembered that, you know, you guys were shooting alongside, and he would come on over and have a look at it, and vice versa and stuff like that.
What was that period like for you? Because Gremlins was, yeah, you'd made films before that, but essentially your first big film, and there it is, opening on the same day as Ghostbusters, but you've got the might of Steven Spielberg behind you and that great marketing campaign with the box and the rules. And were you nervous, excited? Did you sense that you were on the edge of a precipice? Or,
well, I think it all goes back to the day that I got the part. Actually, I'd flown down with some of my high school buddies. I'd flown down to Fort Lauderdale. I was going to do kind of a spring break thing.
Yeah.
And I had landed that, I think, earlier that day. Yeah, earlier that day. Because I had, I'd done my final audition on Thursday.
Okay.
And I'd flown down the next day on Friday. And so I'd landed at around noon, and then I'd gone to the beach and, you know, to the bar, because even though I was 19 back then, the drinking age in the U.S. was 18.
Okay.
So I was having a margarita, and And somewhere along the, oh, that's right, I was having a margarita, and then my friend came from our room and said, you've got a message, so you may want to go up to your room. Your mom said, call back, it's urgent. So I put down my margarita and my whatever Mexican food I was eating at the time. And I went up and I called my mom. And I had played a trick on my mom when I first booked a part. I'd come very, very close for Nothing Lasts Forever. And I hadn't gotten it. And they did done an open casting, hadn't found anyone, and then gone back for a sort of second round and eventually cast me. And when I got it, I went up to her and I was like, Mom, you'll never guess who got Nothing Lasts Forever. And she, her face fell. She goes, who? And I was like, you're looking at him. And she was like, no way, no way. Right? So I was knew I was very close to getting Gremlins. So I called my mom up and I said, what's going on? My mom goes, you'll never guess who got Gremlins. And I went, who? And she goes, you did. And I went, no way. She goes, way. She goes, they have to do all sorts of things. You have to sign all sorts of confidentiality agreements. You got to get on the plane tomorrow.
Jesus.
So nice. I went downstairs to my friends. Of like, what's up? I told them, and there's just stunned silence followed by, wow, whatever. And I don't really remember the rest of the night. I was just in a daze. I just remember that I couldn't sleep. So I walked outside my hotel and I walked down to the beach in Florida and I just looked at the waves crashing on the beach and I thought, your life is probably going to be completely different for the rest of your entire existence after today.
Yeah.
And it was.
I mean, they say never work with kids or kids or animals. Do you include Mogwai and Gremlins in that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, I think as much, you know, I think one of the real things that happened to both me and Phoebe, me especially, Phoebe had a little bit more of a body of work when she did that movie, but I was basically the new kid on the block, was it at the time Spielberg was so omnipotent. You know, coming off of E.T., Jaws, Close Encounters, yep. That's a hell of a run.
Yep.
E.T. was the number one movie of all time. Poltergeist was a huge smash. And now Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom were coming out within 3 weeks of each other. And the anticipation was so amazing. So that I think that everyone, to a certain extent, who was involved with Gremlins kind of got swept along, and some of the credit, especially for Joe Dante, was taken away. And it was sort of like Spielberg movies. Like Spielberg, you know, God bless him, and one of the world's greatest filmmakers, so I'm certainly not going to say anything negative about him. But the truth is, he was in Sri Lanka shooting in Temple of Doom. He had very, you know, little to do with the actual shooting of Gremlins. He had a lot to do with the shaping and molding. I mean, he cast me, for example, and Phoebe. He had casting approval.
Okay.
So Spielberg, you know, had huge amount to do with Chris Columbus and the script in terms of shaping the script and everything like that. But once the cast was in place and the script was done, you know, he left. And I think that, like, if you look at the film, the look and the tone and the pacing and especially the tone is 100% Joe Dante, and it's one of the things that makes it work, along with like things like Phoebe's monologue, which is very Joe Dante's sense of humor and not at all Spielberg's sense of humor.
Yeah.
I don't think Spielberg liked that monologue. I think he thought it was I think he felt it was a bit much, and Joe Dante was like, it's one of the best things in the picture.
How did you and Phoebe feel about that? Because that's one of the most iconic moments in the film, but it's so weird when you watch it. It's so,
well, here's the thing. It was, I think, the main reason why Phoebe wanted to do the movie. Because if you look at her part's pretty small town girl. I mean, there's not really a whole lot of dimension to it if you cut that monologue. If you'd cut that monologue, she just would have been, oh, you know, sort of like Transformers, like the hot girl with the lead guy. So she was desperate to have that monologue in there.
Yeah.
So we shot it, and after we shot it, we were hearing rumors that it might be cut. And she was very, very upset about that, since it was basically her raison d'etre for being in the movie. And and it stayed in. I believe it stayed in at Joe Dante's insistence because he loved it. He thought it was hilarious, and it is.
It's a classic scene.
Classic scene.
It is. You cannot imagine that playing in a Transformers film.
No,
but
no.
It just shows you for that to be in a big summer
absolutely
blockbuster.
It's amazing,
crazy.
Amazing. And again, it goes back to the subversion of Gremlins, and I love the way it itself is subverted in Gremlins 2, where she begins to have another speech and then
about Lincoln's
like,
birthday.
Yeah, about Lincoln's
yeah.
birthday, and then who wants to hear? Yeah. Who wants to listen to this?
Yeah, we had a really tough time shooting that scene because we were cracking up during it. And if you look at the movie, the take that they use, I have to duck behind her head to avoid cracking up. Because I think my line is something like, "Sweet darling, we really have to be going on here." And I start to crack up, so I turn my head to the side, duck it behind her head to avoid cracking up. But you can see me starting to break in it, which is fine. Joe's like, "Ah, that's fine. Man, that's good."
There was a period in Paul McCartney's career where he declared he wasn't going to play any more Beatles tracks live in concert because he was just a little bit fed up of the connection between himself and the Beatles. You know, obvious connection to make. He's since come around, obviously. But was there ever a period in your life when you were like that with Gremlins, where people would just constantly connect you with Gremlins and you were maybe like, oh, well, can we talk about something else?
Well, I shudder to ever compare myself to Paul McCartney because that's a ridiculous comparison.
He didn't star in Gremlins, so.
This is true.
That would have been quite interesting.
It would have been interesting.
But I definitely went through just in one similarity, I definitely went through a period where I was just like, could we shut up about the Gremlins? You know what I mean? Because it was just endless. But I think that's, in a way, that's kind of like the sign of the success of the thing, is it becomes so overwhelming that you go through kind of a Gremlin fatigue, if you would.
Yeah.
But then what happens is you come out the other side of that and you start seeing these things, very subtle things that happen. Like I was watching a television one time, and we have a channel in America called TNT, Turner Network Television.
Yeah.
And it says, I turned it on and I saw Gremlins. And so, you know, I'll always just for fun, I'll watch 30 seconds and then I'll turn it, you know. Oh, this one. Oh, yeah, right. That was a fun day. Whatever. So I watched 30 seconds, and then the thing went, you're watching Gremlins on TNT, the new classics. And I was like, the new classics? Wow, look at that.
Absolutely.
Look at that. Because, you know, I mean, it was, first you go through the phase of, it's a movie, and then it's a good movie, then it's, that movie, it's an old movie. Then it becomes a classic. And when it becomes a classic, you start going, oh, wow. Yeah. There you have it, and you start becoming in. And what's really interesting is that ever since I moved to New York and started teaching acting and writing and branching out, doing other things like that, and not really pursuing the acting career as aggressively as I did when I was living in Los Angeles, you know, my profile got way, way, way lower. And what I've discovered is that when you kind of go away for a while, that when you do sort of reemerge, people like what seems to you as not a lot of time has passed, to especially to younger people and whatever, it feels like a long time. So they're like, wow, so where have you been? And not surprisingly, they're excited to see you again.
Yeah.
As opposed to like when you see someone, you know, every week at the pub, you're like, oh, that guy.
Yeah.
But you go away for 2 years and then you show up back at the pub, everyone's like, hey, buy you around, you know? Thing like that. So I'm getting a lot of that, and it's very deeply surprising to me, but I'm getting a lot, even when I went on Twitter, people, I mean, you know, some of the responses were a cross between strange and you know, deeply, I want to say deeply gratified, deeply polite, let's put it this way.
Okay.
I don't place a lot of stock in the whole idea of fame and celebrity. Ever since I've been a kid, I've always found it to be patently ridiculous. I think it's all incredibly silly. I understand it's there and probably bigger now than it's ever been, and the impact that it has on people from being on a screen and everything. I totally get it, but I think it's incredibly silly.
What made you sign up to Twitter in the first place?
Well, I guess what happened was I saw social media, I saw things like Facebook explode. Yeah. I just felt, I got to find out what all of these things are. And so I got on Twitter and I was like, I think like a lot of people at first, I was like, I don't get it. You know, I kind of didn't get it. And then I thought, I went back to it, and I was very much an observer. I would follow a lot of people, and I had like 35 followers, and then I was just watching. And I'm sort of watching how it, and it was amazing what it kind of turned into. You got news from it, you know, most of it accurate, because it was just linking to, like, you know, reliable sources, if there is such a thing. And a lot of humor. People hipped me to a lot of really cool cultural things.
Yeah.
Have you read this? Have you tried that? Have you seen this?
Yeah.
That's a fantastic part of it. It would make me laugh more than anything else. And even though a lot of people use it as kind of a self-promotional tool, somehow there was something limiting about the 140 characters and something creative about it that made it less solipsistic and narcissistic than Facebook.
Absolutely.
It still is. I'm not going to say it's like, oh, it's like the good one and Facebook's like the evil twin or something like that. It has kind of like a playful thing about it. Even the word tweet, which at first I thought, that's a stupid term. But now I kind of like tweet. It's just like a little frothy little thing that you throw out there to entertain people and make their day better. So I really like it. It's great.
I was enjoying your tweets about the UK. You were listing things you liked.
Oh yeah,
about
did you like
UK.
That?
Yeah, and you're wearing a Union Jack t-shirt today.
Absolutely.
By royal appointment.
I wanted to ask, when you were at an event like the London Film Comic Con, you know, a fan event, obviously a lot of people must be coming up and asking about Gremlins and Waxwork. Mm-hmm. Is there one particularly obscure kind of film that you find has built a fan base that people kind of come up and ask about that surprises you maybe?
Well, I'm always surprised at how many people have seen the two Waxwork movies, because you got to understand, when Waxwork came out, I don't want to say it bombed, because it didn't bomb, but it just sort of came out and it did what it did and it went. And it had kind of like a cult following. And Waxwork 2, you know, much less of an impact, I would say. So when people come up with both of those double DVD discs, I'm always kind of surprised about that. There is one thing that I did called Surviving, which was a kind of like a teenage, it was like a teen suicide movie that I did with Molly Ringwald and River Phoenix and Marsha Mason, Ellen Burstyn, incredible cast, Paul Sorvino, amazing, amazing thing. And somebody posted it on YouTube recently in like 10 parts, you know how they do that?
Yes.
It's like, and so a few people have been coming up and talking about that, and that's been very gratifying, because it was only shown on US TV, and I think it's probably the best thing I've ever done.
Oh, fantastic. Must feel good then when that happens as well. And you know, I'm a big fan of Waxwork. I have to say, I mean, I grew up watching it loads of times. And Waxwork 2 is interesting as well, because it has, both of those movies are kind of self-reflexive in a way. I mean, they parody other horror films and other horror genres. And Bruce Campbell is famously in Waxwork 2 with the exposed wounds and the salt.
Yeah.
What was that like working with Bruce?
Well, I was a huge Evil Dead fan. Before I was an actor, I saw Evil Dead in the theater. Like, it happened, came out in 82, I think. I saw it in the theater, and actually right near where I live now, on 86th Street in Manhattan. And I found it really scary at the time.
Okay.
I mean, even with the claymation stuff, I found that thing in the basement.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just deeply disturbing, you know, and a whole lot of the tone of the movie. Really. So I thought he was really cool. Then when I met him, he's a really interesting looking person in life, in real life. He actually is one of the few people I've met, and he's a handsome guy, so I'm not saying anything bad, but he looks like a cartoon character. He's got this very prominent chin, and it's no wonder he played Dudley. Didn't he do Dudley Do Right?
Brenton Fraser did it.
Oh,
but he played a character similar to that. Yeah.
He should have played Dudley Do Right, because Bruce looks exactly like Dudley Do Right. Mm. I mean, he has amazing features. He's a very handsome guy, but in a very comic book come to life kind of way. And he was just, you know, he was a great guy. He was only there for a day, but we had a good time. And
but what a day.
Yeah, it was quite a day.
We had
a lot of fun shooting that scene. I'm wearing that ridiculous Roger Daltrey wig.
Just constantly throwing salt on his wounds as well.
Exactly. That scene was complete madness.
So you've worked with Ash, Dracula, two of the Ghostbusters. Not bad.
Steed from the Avengers.
That was huge. Working with Patrick was huge, because I grew up with the Avengers.
Oh, wow. Well,
my dad loved them.
Yeah.
My dad loved them, yeah.
He's awesome in that film as well. But now, I mean, you're back. You say you're teaching acting, but is acting fully on the back burner for you now? I mean,
No. I would say, here's one of the things that happened with Hatchet 3, which is very interesting how that came about. I literally was sitting at my girlfriend's family's computer. I was in Knoxville, Tennessee, and I'm looking at my email, and I don't know if you guys get tons of spam, but I get tons of junk email. So I look at it and it goes, Hatchet 3 offer. And I go, Hatchet 3 offer. What does that even mean? That was the subject line. Then I saw it was from my agent. I went, hang on, Hatchet 3 offer. Let me read this. I was like, oh, offer for a movie. Like, I couldn't remember the last time someone had offered me a film. Offers now, you know, basically there are about 50 people in Hollywood, in the world, maybe less, who actually get offers for stuff. Even for things like, you know, Hunger Games, stuff like that, people have to audition against serious competition. So it's like, offer, what does that mean? So I looked at the script and I was laughing at it, not or with it, I should say, because it was really witty and funny. I was like, wow, I see, they're completely subverting the genre. It's full of 80s references. Have you seen either one of the Hatchet ones or twos?
Yeah.
So it's very much like sort of Friday the 13th. Yeah. The gore is very over the top, and so I was laughing at it, and I really liked it. So I was like, I went on IMDb, I was like, who is this Adam Green guy, you know, who's this person? So the more I read about him, the more he seemed like a very smart, shrewd, up-and-coming guy. I thought, wow, you know, this is a good person to kind of get to know. And the script was funny. And the character was great. Again, I can't talk too much about it, but it's Southern Sheriff thrust into a rather remarkable situation. So they let me do whatever I wanted to do with it. So I have this Houston accent through the whole thing, talking like this. It's just unbelievable that I get to do that with the guns and the whole thing. It's just so much fun.
Is it a particularly heroic part for you?
Yeah. It's what's cool about it is it's a badass part too. Oh, cool. I got my Glock 9mm, and there's a tremendous amount of an unbelievable amount of gunfire in this movie. Like,
and I imagine that a lot of blood as well. I mean, he throws the Scarlet around.
This is going to be for people who like the Hatchet movies. The Hatchet 1 was good in and of itself. It's a classic. Number 3 takes everything and multiplies it by 10. I think there's about something like 30 kills in the movie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
No spoilers. I can't give spoilers.
Understood.
There's a ton of violence.
Yeah.
A ton of action. A ton of blood and entrails flying everywhere. And it's hilarious. At the same time,
I mean,
there were times where we were weeping with laughter, so we would have to. But we were supposed to be playing it straight, so there are things that we had to.
Yeah,
it was. Let's just put it this way: it's a tremendous amount of fun, and I was very, very surprised at. I thought it would look good, you know, because these guys are good at what they do. But they shot it in like a 2.85, anamorphic.
Okay,
and. Will Barrett, the DP, has completely outdone himself, and BJ McDonald, the director, who's a Steadicam operator, did a fantastic job on it. It looks enormous. It looks like a $10 million movie. Well, it's not a $10 million movie.
That's fantastic. Adam Green's kind of at the forefront of the new wave of horror in a way, with people like Adam Wingard and Ty West. So yeah. Very, very exciting about that. I just want to. It's obviously a threequel, and you weren't involved in the first two. But you were involved in the first two Gremlins, and there's been talk for a long, long time about a third movie in that series.
Right.
What's your feeling in that? I'm not asking for latest news, but do you have a feeling, should there be a Gremlins 3? And if there were to be one, would you be interested?
Well, you'd be an idiot if you were me not to want to be in the third one. You're always going to want to be in one of the more successful franchises. Even though the second one didn't do that amazing box office in the U.S., it did something like $100 million worldwide.
Wow.
Excuse me. It did like 48.
Yeah.
Somewhere around that in the U.S. and it did another $100 million.
That's especially for 1990. That's pretty good.
Yeah. So the thing about it is, I think it boils down to this. CGI. Three letters. That's what it boils down to. And I know that everyone involved who would be interested in doing a third one, Joe, Mike Fennell, everybody involved with it, wants to do the animatronics. They want to do the puppets.
The
puppets now would probably be grotesquely expensive. I think the budget on two in 1990 was like 30 or 32.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So now you're talking 22 years later. you've got to imagine you're looking at $200 million or something like that.
Mm. Wow.
And what most people don't know about Gremlins also is, let's very quickly look at the shooting schedule. 4.5 months with humans, and then an additional 4.5 months second unit with just puppets. So it's a 9-month shoot on both of them.
Right.
So now you're doing 9 months of shooting.
Yeah.
Right.
So you've got to be committed.
Well, you've got to, if once you're in as Warner Brothers, you're in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's going to be expensive. So I think that's where the impasse is. The impasse is the studio wants to do it for 100 and they're like 100 million apart or something like that.
It's interesting because the Muppets obviously came out recently. Mm-hmm. Didn't use CG, used puppets, and was a hit. And there's now another one coming out, so that kind of shows that you can do it. And that was the charm of that film, was that they didn't use CG.
Right. The sort of counter argument, if I was Warner Brothers, I would make to that is that the animatronics are incredibly more expensive and difficult and technical than hand puppets.
Sure.
Or puppets with a couple of the wires or things that they have.
We'll build a couple.
Yeah, we'll kind of spur of time. We'll see.
We'll get our readers to get their talk.
Have you ever had conversations with Joe about number three and about what it might be if it were to happen? And do you keep in touch with each other about it just in case? Because I know he's been trying to make it happen, hasn't he, for a while?
I really don't know how much he has or hasn't. You'd have to ask him that.
Yeah,
I would imagine that he would probably have some. But you know, I think he had some gremlin fatigue too for a while. Where if you think that I was tired or Phoebe was tired after doing the first, two, he really, both he and Mike, when you would see them at the end of the shooting, after they did the 5 months of. I mean, that's a long time. Days a week, 5 months, 12-hour days.
Maybe puppets, so you're getting, maybe 10 seconds a day, something like that?
They were exhausted, It was an incredibly hard movie to do. So I think that there was a period, and again, you'd have to ask Joe this, but I think there was a period where he was like, as he would say, thank you, no. He would always put no on the end of the thing. He goes, thank you, no. So I don't think that he wanted. Now probably enough time's gone by, you're talking about 20 years for God's sake, more.
Absolutely.
Where he probably my guess is he probably got the hankering to do one again, maybe 5-7 years ago, something like that. So I see him at conventions every now and then. I saw him in Indianapolis was the last time, and I think it's just the CGI deal.
Story wise, do you see there being places where this story can go? I remember reading a rumor about Gremlins in the White House. I don't know if that came from anywhere.
Yeah.
But
I mean, the great thing about the Gremlins franchise is you can basically stick them anywhere and kind of have a fun time.
Yeah.
I know you're going to think this is shameless pandering, but I actually have like a 6-page treatment that I wrote out about Gremlins in London.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And because I thought that I think that's a great mix, the kind of the gremlins running into especially maybe the upper class strata of Britain. It's very sort of obsessed with control and order and etiquette.
Stiff upper lip and...
Yes. And so what's the opposite of stiff upper lip and doing things the correct way?
Yeah.
I say, you should not do that, young green thing. Get down there. What do you think you're doing? I mean, the possibilities are pretty endless.
Absolutely. That'd be amazing. So when did you write that?
I wrote that about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
And because I suddenly sort of sat up in my bed, and because I almost never think about gremlins. One of the funny things about gremlins is I don't think about it. I walk around just living my life.
Yeah.
It's something I did two decades ago. So I don't wake up in the morning and go, the gremlin guy, let's have tea. Oh, gremlins. I don't think that way.
You have to go to the gremlin cup.
Exactly.
Where's gremlin Gizmo? Cover.
Check on the closet, make sure Gizmo's okay. I mean, I don't do that. Although some people would, probably spoil some people's fantasies and stuff like that. I wake up and I'm like, oh, I'll go and I'll have some dumplings in the corner. That's what I do. And a lot of times... Especially if I do something like grow a beard or I have a tendency to walk around sometimes Manhattan just looking like hell. Sweats, I haven't shaved in 5 days, bedhead, wearing some t-shirt that's completely been torn up by my cat because the cat's been on my shoulders when I'm riding.
Yeah.
I've got a cat that likes to sit on my shoulder. So a lot of times nobody ever recognizes. So months can go by. before. Then something will happen. I've got an audition. I'll shave. I'll clean up. You know, pull myself together and I'll walk around and you know, lose some weight. And then suddenly people are like, "Hey, aren't you that guy?" And I'm like, "Yes, yes. Oh right, oh right. That's right. I did that." And sometimes I actually forget. I mean, the weeks
and then
can
you
go
talk
by.
To people like us. It's just gremlins, gremlins.
You know, I imagine that George Harrison might have had that experience because, you know, he lived in that Friar Park thing up by Henley on Thames. Actually had the incredible good fortune to visit the Harrison estate.
Oh, wow.
Because my friend Carrie Elways is friends with Danny Harrison.
Okay.
So I got to meet Olivia and Danny and the whole family and get a tour through Friar Park and everything like that. But there were months when George Harrison, like, never left his... And why would he? I mean, everything he needed was right there. It was fantastic. Amazing garden. They have a thing like the Matterhorn in Disney that's like in the backyard, like far in the backyard. It's like, it's acres and acres. It's immense.
That's
immense. So it's brilliant. But I'm sure that he probably spent, you know, there were times when he spent 3 or 4 months on his property and probably forgot. You know, woke up one day and had an entire day where he was like so busy, you know, gardening and this and that. He said he just forgot he was a Beatle. Now, he didn't wake up and go, "Oh, I'm the guitar player in the Beatles." He woke up and he's like, "I'm George. I'd like a cup of tea." Not that I'm, again, not that comparing myself to a Beatle.
Well, that's two down so far. So exactly. Just two more to go. I just want to ask a very, very quick question about this treatment. What prompted it? If you're a year and a half ago, suddenly this thought pops into your head, "Oh, I've got an idea for Gremlins 3. What was the eureka moment for you?
Well, what prompted it was I've written this script with one of my co-writers, a guy named Dustin Warburton, who's done all of these really entertaining kids books. I've written a script called The Windmill Kids, and it's kind of like Ghostbusters Junior. It's sort of almost like a Goonies remake, but with a twist.
Okay.
Sort of like a Ghostbusters. It's very, very 80s, very much the tone of like Super 8. Do you guys Super 8?
Yeah, really good.
So, because my feeling is like that I love 80s movies. And I think that's why Adam Green offered me the movie, because he's obsessed with the 80s. And Gremlins is one of his favorite movies.
Yeah.
So, I just love the tone of those movies like Temple of Doom, Last Crusade. It just has a feeling about it. It's hard to describe what it is. It has a kind of optimistic, fun, family-friendly, but not wimpy... like too Disneyfied version.
Absolutely.
Of it.
Yeah.
So I wrote this and actually Dustin got in contact with Warner Brothers and they're like, "We're very interested in taking a look at the script. And if Zach feels like it, if he wants to sit down and throw out some Gremlin 3 ideas, we'd love to hear them." So now I'm going like, crikey, right? It's, you know, Warner Brothers saying they're interested in hearing. So I thought to myself, I said, "I don't really have any Gremlins 3 ideas, to be honest. I've got nothing." Nothing. So I went to sleep, and obviously I don't want to give it away. I thought of something, and suddenly that gave me an idea that had to do with Gizmo, and let's just say how he would get to England.
Yeah, okay.
And suddenly I sat bolt upright in my bed, and I went, "Oh my God, that, I think that is hilarious." And just from that little kernel, it all sort of kind of like fell into place. Once I really put the franchise in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
It had something to do with the way the world is now.
Okay.
And I linked that with the old 80s thing, and suddenly I was like, yeah, because Billy and Kate would be alive, they'd be living in clam corners, you know, and then this would happen, which happens to everybody, and you'd go, oh, and that thing. So I don't want to give it away. Sorry to be like...
No. It's
secretive
good.
And stuff like that, yeah. But you
so
can't...
So Billy is still alive, he hasn't been gremlinized at some point.
Billy's the dad now. Okay. See, I've just basically filled in the Hoyt position.
Oh, okay.
It's just Phoebe and I, you see, Phoebe and I are now just Hoyt and Francis Lee McCain's parts, that's all.
Mm. Okay, interesting.
It's very interesting that people at Warner Brothers are actively thinking about this and trying to get...
Well, you have to put yourself in an executive's position, okay? Executives are basically terrified of one thing, losing their job. It's the only thing that they want to do is hang on to their job. So they are the most risk-averse people in the world. So people go, how come there's been no Gremlins 3? Well, look at Ghostbusters 3.
Yeah.
Nobody will ever greenlight that movie unless Bill Murray's in it. I don't actually believe that they will. Because if they do it and it fails, they go, why didn't you wait for Murray to sign off on this script? You're fired. So I really honestly would bet my life that they will not make that movie unless Bill Murray is attached to it. It simply won't happen. So I think that as far as Gremlins 3 is concerned, the one thing you want for a 3 is you're either going to reboot it, which they very well might do,
yeah,
and then they'll give me the part where I walk in and go, isn't that the, and you know, the glorified cameo kind of thing, like
you'll
that.
You'll be a Mr. Futterman or something.
That's fine. Or if they're going to do Gremlins 3, they have to have certain key elements attached to it for job security. So they have to have Joe Dante. They have to have... They probably have to have, like, myself and Phoebe in order for them... They don't need to. They can do whatever they want. But in order for them to feel invulnerable, mm-hmm, and protected, mm-hmm, they're going to want something so that, you know... And Spielberg, obviously, would be the number one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, if it fails for $150 million, they'll go... Someone on the board will turn to them and say, how on earth did you greenlight this without X, Y, and Z? Mm. So the cover your ass... mentality out there, I think, is a large part of what's preventing anybody from moving forward.
One last Gremlins question, Zach, I promise you, before we let you go, because you've been
fantastic. I don't have Gremlins fatigue now at all.
Oh, you might have after this. You never know. When you were on set shooting with these incredible puppets, these Chris Wallace puppets and Rick Baker and, you know, all those guys, who did the voices? I presume Harry Mandel and Frank Welker weren't on set.
Oh, no, they weren't. There weren't any voices.
Yeah.
Like, when I had the gizmo in my hand, what I heard was this. Little clicking, whirring sounds. Because it's very small, so the cogs were small. If they were larger, they probably wouldn't... But they were tiny little things, so it was just... So that's all I ever heard. Because the contraption was wired... to my body.
Right.
The wires came down out from basically out of his butt. And the wires would come down. They'd be taped down my body, and they would go down my body, and they would come out a hole in my sock. And then each wire, there were probably about 8 wires, would go to a joystick. And each technician would control a various part of the gizmo. So one person would do their arms, one person would do the ears, one person would do the nose, one person would do the mouth. Each person would have a camera, a video monitor, so they could watch. And they spent months practicing before we even got there so that they could go. And Chris Wallace would be on the side. He would say something like, he would say, Zach, do whatever you want to do, but try and do it just a little slowly. So if you're going to scritch his head slowly. So I would, like, reach over, I'd scritch his head, and I'd hear Chris Wallace. They turned my volume up and his volume were very low, and he would go, react, more ears. So I'm acting, okay? I'm standing up. I'm dragging 8 technicians attached to my leg, okay? I've got wires running down the side of my body that are taped to me, that every time someone pulls a joystick is pinching, like, my hair and my flesh.
Oh, my God.
So I have to ignore the physical discomfort. I have to ignore the conversations that are going on behind me. And if that wasn't preposterous enough, they're all walking around, like, on crab legs, squatted down on crab legs. Because if you watch Gremlins... nothing is shot from the waist down.
Okay.
It's all sort of from the waist up, medium-sized shots.
Yeah.
That's because the technicians' heads are literally about 2 to 2.5 inches below the frame line as they're crab walking with their joysticks and monitors attached to them. I mean, it was insanity. Absolute insanity. So there'd no voices. A lot of times there weren't gremlins. I mean, basically, the experience would be like, say, you're standing there, right? Joe will say, look over there in the corner of the door. And you look there and he goes, okay, there's a huge gremlin. Be scared. There was nothing there. So a lot of, you know, a lot of the reactions where I'm freaking out, I'm just freaking out to just images in my head. There's nothing there at all.
So that sort of Bob Hoskins when Who Framed Roger Rabbit experience where he started to hallucinate and see Roger Rabbit and Weedles for a month's end.
Yeah.
Well, that's I can imagine why you got Gremlins fatigue at a certain point, but cool. Zach Galligan, it has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for stopping by.